You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
What drives you to make bold moves? To build something that didn't exist before? To live, lead, and choose life with intention? Welcome to Perspective X. I'm Pauline Fatoi, and this is not your typical business podcast. Each episode, I get to speak to extraordinary entrepreneurs and leading innovators to unpack what truly fuels their journey. Not just the wins, but the inner work, the overlooked decisions, the mindset shifts, and the personal moments that sparked something bigger. This show is about the ripple effect of choice, the kind of deep accountability that lets us respond to life rather than react to it. Because when you realize everything is temporary and you are the creator of your own experience, you start to play the game differently. So, if you're curious about how people build meaning alongside success, how they evolve through challenges and shape the world with intention, this is your invitation to listen in. Perspective X, where we go beyond the highlight reel and into the moments that changed everything. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, it's Mick Lubinskas here from Climate Salad. We're here for another chat with an Australian company building out incredible climate solutions for the world. Massive thank you to the New South Wales Government and the Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water for their support building the climate tech industry here in New South Wales in Australia and helping us take these companies to the world. Today we have Dan from DNA Energy. Dan, great to have you.
Thanks, Mick. Likewise, good to be here.
And Dan, we've known each other for a while now. We've seen the company really develop and grow. We've been on at least a couple of major events and some trade missions. But for those who obviously don't know what you do with the story, let's start with the basics. Give us the DNA Energy pitch.
Yeah, cool. So we help businesses and energy utilities expedite their energy transition. The way we do that is we install a bunch of tech, hardware and software in commercial buildings, connect to stuff like HVAC, solar batteries, heat pumps, and then we turn all those assets into digitized nodes that's then controllable by them, us, or their energy utility.
Fantastic. Tell us a bit about why are companies wanting to do that? What's their big benefit they get out of it? And what kind of people within the company do you interact with normally?
We started off thinking we're going to solve some problems and how scalable is that? But there are a lot of problems in the energy transition. So it turns out it's very scalable. A lot of the work we've done is around constrained supplies. So like schools or aged care sites who are building new wings or they're putting EV charging in, something like that, and there's not enough supply to the site. And so their one option is, you've got a $150,000, $200,000 supply upgrade and a 15-month wait, or you can install our system for a fraction of that cost and we're in and out with a month or so. We're starting to see the ESG movement transfer from CEOs made a statement to, we actually got to do something about this, we understand, we're not yet in a world where people are doing it because they want to do it. It's got to make economic sense. And so how can we frame a business case around that ESG story? We do a bunch of reporting. The more recent piece we've got onto, which is the original thing that we always wanted to do in the company, is monetizing those assets in VPP or demand response programs. And so bringing in the energy utility to that story, is turbocharging for the grid transformation, but also adds really nice revenues around it as well. So it puts it all in a nice, neat package. The people we deal with across the facilities, finance, sustainability are always stakeholders. The facilities manager needs to know what's going on. The finance guy needs to know what they're paying for. Sustainability, always want to frame a story around it. When we're dealing with the retailers and utilities, trading desk sales, commercial, a really wide spectrum of stakeholders for sure.
Yeah, fantastic. So there's definitely a few things in there to drill into. I want to start by thinking about where are we in terms of the transition. So you mentioned the end consumers of the environment would like us to be in a climate positive state right now, but we're talking about changing nearly every system and asset in the world. And as you said, but the distance between the CEO saying, we would like to be sustainable and setting a big goal that might be long term in the future and actual action. And you're dealing with a dozen different people and groups doing really complicated, hard things. Where is your sense that we're still having early conversation and doing the first part of that? Are we somewhere in the middle? Are we years away? How are you feeling about the progress we're all making?
I think we're frighteningly early in the process, and earlier. I think if you read some of the journos in our industry, there's a bit of high-fiving going on. I think it's a bit too early, to be honest with you. I think saying we've set a target and saying there's, you know, 8 gazillawatts of, you know, of generation backed up, it's a great story, but we're not high-fiving yet. And I think the gap is huge, actually. And the gap is huge partly because people, I think, are just starting to realize what it means. And then they're looking at it, and it's really difficult. You know, the energy gods, unfortunately, won't just make everything just kind of work. You've got to orchestrate it. You've got to manage it. You've got to think it through. There's a labor shortage. There's a supply shortage. There's an emotive shortage, you know, across the business. And so I think there's a lot of challenges that we're just starting to get into, actually.
A lot of these things, they happen really gradually and then really suddenly. You know, what you're doing is complicated because people go through it the first time. But do you get a sense that people going through the second time, or people sort of following the early adopters, like, is it going to speed up, or is it going to be hard, slow work for 20 years?
No, I think the slow, 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 fast thing is very accurate, actually. We had a conversation this morning, actually, about a specific application, and it's taken us about a year and a half to get this one application over the line. I think we'll do two of them, and I know the next one will take 2 weeks or 4 weeks, you know. We had an instance recently, you know, the retailers have been a real focus of ours. We had an amazing case study with the retailer and an awesome customer. And it took us about a year and a half to get the deal over the line, and then a year to get the case study proof case. And then we took that case study to another retailer, and it took 3 months to get them on board. And I think that's a case of just people are wary. It's new. How does it work? You know, we've got trading risks. We've got these problems that we understand them and we know how to manage them. And I think people want to see that case study, and, you know, no one wants to be first of the kind, first in the market, right? And so a lot of the challenge, I think, is having that stickability and the staying power to see it through, and the belief, you know, the startup founders out there, you doubt themselves, you just got to keep on kicking the doors down, right? And you've got to keep on believing. It's tough, but it does take off.
You brought up first of a kind there, FOAK. Some people say folk, FOAK, whatever.
There's another one. There's another way you could produce that. You could say that if you're a founder as well, isn't there? Yeah.
That's true. It depends where you are on the emotional roller coaster on any particular day. I share that as well. So it is, it's really interesting that it's obviously been around a lot in other big technology infrastructure, but it's particularly, I think, climate. It is a big factor, and it goes towards that point you said about the timing and the pressure of the CEO going, we've said stuff, now we have to do stuff. Can you talk a bit about, like, from I think in the sense of the economic benefit, because obviously if you can go to someone and say, well, we just save you millions of dollars a year, and it's easy and obvious, you'd think you get lots of customers, but it's not necessarily that easy. But can you tell us about, like, what's driving either the increased demand for conversations and solutions, or the increased economic benefit? Like, what's driving it to be a better proposition?
I think the complexity of what companies are doing is a big driver. You know, people want to get more efficient stuff. They want to look at EVs. You know, their mate works for a company that got solar, and they're looking at batteries, and the pressure to do that is increasing rapidly. It's really exponential, to be honest with you, but it's complicated. It's really hard. You know, you don't just buy a battery and it works, and you don't just say, I want to get some EVs and install them, and they charge you, make money out of it. It's not that simple. And so I think the way the industry is going is putting a lot of pressure on that, and that's unearthing a lot of these challenges which require the solutions. It's a dollar conversation. That's what it always comes down to, right? You can dress it up however you want. It always comes down to the buck. And there's one or two companies, I think, who would genuinely want to do it, and they're willing to take a risk. But most companies just either want to be seen to do it, or there's pressure to do it, or they think it's a really cool idea, but it's got to be cash positive, not even cash neutral. You've got to make money from it.
And for DNA Energy, is this, you mentioned the first one taking a long time, the second one might take 2 weeks. In terms of actual implementation and being able to point to clear value, is like, what's that like? What's that cycle look like?
In terms of how we deliver projects?
Yeah.
There's a lot of variables around there. A lot of it comes to the customer interaction, to be honest with you. If you've got an engaged customer that's got the information, you know, we can turn around something in a week or two if you have to. It's normally not that simple, though. You know, there's multiple stakeholders. You miss a board meeting. They don't have the information you want. They don't understand why it's important. And so, with some things drag on, some simple things drag on for months and months, it's really, really frustrating. Where we're trying to fix that is to systemize things and automate them and clear the message up and you know, we did it wrong last time. How can we do it slightly better? What was that customer engagement? Did we speak to the right person? Are they going to buy it? Do they really want to buy it? Is there budget for it? You know, all those, a lot of the 101 sales things that I think are quite hard to forget when you're in tech and you're trying to do something really cool and you forget, did I even check if there's budget for this? You know, I've got a sales background. I remember the first time it happened, it was like, how did I not make that the very first question? You know, can you write that check? Because if you can't write that check, I really need to speak to the person that does, or make sure they're on the next meeting, you know? And I think there's just a lot of complexity around it, and a lot of it is new. And, you know, people are waking up to it. But, yeah, getting stakeholders on board and budget and timing and, you know, you want to deal with the school. If you're not there by September, you miss their 2025 budget and you're not getting this into the year after. And, you know, there's those things you have to understand around the cyclical nature of it, of course.
Yeah, there's a ton of lag in it, right? I think that's the reality. And some of the systems we're talking about have been kind of slowly evolving over 200 years. And there are some things which are big, lumpy decisions, like buying big assets or like a country thinking about their energy sources is, you know, it's a bit harder. Your speed of value is a little bit better, right? But is that helpful, or is that actually sometimes better to be having the bigger conversations that are $100 million deals? But do you feel that potential faster sales cycle? I know it's been hard. How do you find that?
It's a great question. We get kind of a few sides of the same coin. We sometimes get, oh yeah, we're speaking to people that do that, and it's like, my messaging must be wrong because that's not the case. I know you're not speaking to five people who are doing the same thing as we're doing. I think the ticket size makes it very challenging sometimes, and we don't think about it that often. You know, the first system we sold, we charged X for, then we charged 2X and then 3X. And it's like, well, someone's still paying this, you know, it's incredible. And it's an interesting piece. You know, you sometimes want to slip under that level that it requires scrutiny. But at the same time, if you're below a certain level, people taking it that seriously, you know, and getting the pricing right when you're doing something where there's not 10 years of history is actually really difficult to do it. You know, you want to create value. You want to make enough money to keep on developing and growing the business and, you know, paying the bills and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's a really interesting case. You know, sometimes, you know, we sell $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 systems. Would it make it easier for $1 million? Maybe, for sure, because it gets taken more seriously. It goes through a more known process of, okay, checkpoint A, checkpoint B, checkpoint B, 10 to 3 people, you're the winner, great. That's really easy to understand. But, you know, I'm going to buy this $35,000 system that's telling me they're going to solve that problem that I didn't really think would be solved like that. You know, that is tricky sometimes.
Yeah, that's, and I know you've seen the back of your shirt a number of times. Yeah, energy is a revenue, and business model innovation is that as important as technological innovation in solving climate problems, do you think?
The business model is really important. We only kind of worked out this year what problem we're solving, which sounds ridiculous after 5 years, but you know, you have a pivot or two, and as a startup, you kind of realize what that is. We realize now that the problem we're solving is the grid problem, and it's not a business problem per se. That's just something that happens as part of it. And so the business model that we now have is we want to work with retailers, and that's our business model. And how do we make it as easy as possible to deal with the retailers so they don't have to worry about dealing with 1,000 customers? We'll do that because we do it anyway downstream. And that's just not been done before. And, you know, that's, you know, the same previously, it took a year and a half or 2 years to get the first retailer over the line, then a year of running it before. You know, everyone goes, yeah, it's really successful, but can we scale it? And they're like, let's just wait for a bit longer and a bit longer because this really is new. And how do we do this? And so I don't think we've finished our business model evolution. I think we'll refine it and we'll get better at it. If I ever tell you that we've nailed everything, feel free to give me a slap, because you've got to keep moving. But yeah, I think that's a lot of what climate tech founders in these years go through is actually, how do I do that? I've got an awesome product. I need to make money, and I can't just pay the bills. I've got to have money to develop, and I've got to create something that my customer's just not used to doing. You know, that's two or three pretty profound challenges there.
And I know we got to watch in some English Premier League over in San Francisco. So as Australians doing that, we've got a bit of a global perspective there. Can you tell us a bit about how you see the different markets around the world and how are they responding to the DNA product differently?
Yeah, I'm going to preface it by saying that the best advice I've heard about going global is in the Climate Salad Going Global program, specifically around don't hone your model locally, and then wait till it's perfect to take it overseas because you'll change it. And, you know, conceptually, we kind of knew that. And I heard it a lot this year from yourself and other people in the cohort. And it really makes sense. You know, we're looking at the US market. And although we will actually have a slight product change, but the business model is completely different because the industry is different there. You know, same language, there's electrons, there's transmission, distribution, and retail. You think it will be the same. It really, how we apply ourselves is completely different. We're looking at the, it's kind of scrambling my brain, but the US, the UK market as well. And people keep saying you should look at the UK market. There's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of stuff in Malaysia and Vietnam that's really, really exciting. And they've got so many nuances for the same product. You know, we want to control stuff. We want to control electrons. It should be the same everywhere. But yeah, I feel that if you're looking at a new market, you pretty much got to start from scratch. Know what you do, know what your strengths are. But I think if you're not going to the trade shows, you're not meeting people, you're not having 50 calls a month and speaking to those people, speaking to suppliers, speaking to the customers, speaking to maybe partners, maybe frenemies, you know, I think you've got to build that picture. It's taken us a year and a half, I'd say, maybe a bit more scope in the US to really understand what our place is there and how we really smash it. Take any less than that. If you have hardware particularly, I think if you take any less than that, then you're probably doing yourself a disservice.
In that recent trip to San Francisco for the Verge event, we had a massive week of activities. Any particular surprises or insights that you got from that trip that particularly it influenced the work you're doing at DNA?
We had a doubling down, really, of a lot of things. A lot of them is basic human stuff that you often forget. You know, face-to-face meetings worth a million phone calls. Sometimes it's an infinite amount of phone calls because you might just never get that piece. I think I'm going to be a bit cheesy about it, being around the cohort and being around other startup founders and then adding on, you know, we're in a different country. It just, there's a lot of security and familiarity around it that I think is really, really important. You know, I got to have a one-on-one chat with a CEO of one of our target customers in what I now know is 100% going to be our business model in the US. And so things like that were just really, really exciting. I've probably been there enough recently that the insights were probably had a trip or two ago, but it was a great opportunity to go there and take all those learnings and go, right, I'm really confident now what we're going to do. We're going to stop searching for the model and I'm going to try and apply the model. And I think you've got to be in country to do that, right? It's pretty much impossible to not be the case.
Yeah, the two really big hypotheses we had is going early, and it's actually, I think, significantly harder for hardware companies because it's just you need a place to be able to go and build your product, but then deployment is a whole other story, right? I think that is really, really key. And then actually just being able to spend the time, and it was a big topic of conversation about, for Australian companies, is like, can you do the old SaaS model and stay in Australia and ship it around the world? Or do you need someone in country? And yeah, I think it's, I think that the consensus was that, depending on your model, but most people are going to have someone in country or someone spending at least half of the year there. So, was that your sense as well after a couple of trips?
Scarily was the first trip, and yeah, each time I go there, it's the same. You know, we've got a guy now in the US who's working on behalf of us on a contract basis, which is kind of our first toe in the water. By complete awesome chance, I think we're about to get our first pilot. You know, touch wood, in the same city as the guy works. It's just turned out very fortuitously. But to scale it, someone's got to be there. You know, the cost. I haven't been to other countries, but the cost in the US. And the risk of hiring a country manager that's not already in your world is unreasonable. It's just not palatable, to be honest with you. You know, it'd be cheaper for me to fly over every other month, to be honest with you, and stay in a nice hotel than it would be to hire an in-country person. And then the risk factors and the uncertainty and all that kind of scary stuff as a startup. You've just got to be there. There's no way around it.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned as well in terms of frenemies, it's in in the climate side, we have over 700 companies, and obviously there's not 700 completely different businesses with different approaches. Can you talk about in terms of like, and you've been in business for a while in doing other things, like how do you find the industry in terms of collaboration and working together, and any good stories to share about working with other companies building solutions?
I think as long as everyone's got their big boys pants on, I think it can work really well. There's one or two companies, you know, in the current climate solar cohort who really, they don't do what we do, but it's close enough. And to the untrained eye and the untrained customer in particular, they might think, you guys say, you kind of feel a little, you know, doing it different, but you feel like the same kind of outcome. I think it's doubly important to have relationships with those people. partly because you learn off them. You know, we all have different experiences, and I think if everyone's sensible about it, you know, I'm not talking to you as another founder because I'm trying to rip your customers off. I might just want to learn stuff, or might want to impart something that I know, and then everyone kind of does better for it. I think one of the dangers of being kind of, you know, new or first of a kind, it's really bloody hard to get traction if no one's talking about it, you know? Really, really difficult. And so the more people that do it, if you back yourself to do well, there's more than enough food to go around, right? Absolutely. Probably the best example of where it's worked out well was in the Climate Salad event this week, talking to a co-founder who I've chatted with before. I've got huge respect for their products, an amazing product. Very small crossover with what we do, an absolute crossover, but really not much. You know, just great guy, great founder, great company, been to the office, seen the product, it's amazing. And we were talking about jobs that we're pitching for. And he said, oh, you know, I'm pitching for this job. You know, so I actually think DNA could do part of the job. And I'm thinking, yeah, we've got one. I think you could probably fill the piece as well. And it was the same tender. And I think we're one of two on the tender. And so we're potentially looking to collaborate on that. And rather than be one of two, why don't you be two of two? And that's the kind of piece that I think that you would unlikely find in another industry. I can't imagine two banks or two recruitment companies or two Googles thinking, yeah, I want to buddy up with you because I think A, we'll deliver an awesome product to the customer. B, you never know what's going to happen. I said, let's just make sure we win the damn business, right? And so I can't think of many industries where you get. I can't imagine BMW and Mercedes collaborating to try and do something, or, you know, Androids and OS, you know. So I think it's a real kind of unique industry in that respect. The power of the cohort is strong.
Dan, it's been an incredible year. It's been really great to see how far you've come. Tell us what's coming up next. What's 2025 look like?
Busy, which is awesome. We're going to really focus on this retailer piece. For us, the energy retailers and maybe the DNSPs in Australia are a big focus. We've cracked the nut of how to deal with them, and we understand a lot more nuances than we did previously around how they want to interact with us and companies like us. So that's our key focus. We've got a bunch of customers that we've got that want to do more business that we're absolutely going to service. But I think bringing those retailers into the conversation just makes so much more sense. It makes it more valid for us. The revenues are insane in some cases, to be honest with you. And we make a genuine difference to the businesses, but to the energy transition. And I genuinely believe that what we're doing at scale makes a difference. The overseas piece is very important to us. I do hope and believe that we're about to get this pilot, which would be pretty exciting in the US, which is with a big brand name that would be a fantastic arrival place for us, a great line in the sand and the beachhead. Those will be the two key focuses, noting you never know what's around the corner and things happen, hopefully more great things than not great things. But that is the focus for 2025 for sure.
Fantastic. And how do you think about building your team? Are you investing for growth? Is it step by step? Is it just finding great people and building them around you? Yeah, any thoughts on team strategy?
Yeah, really challenging to get that right. We're very much of the belief of get the people when you need them. Don't get the people and plan for success. I think there's a lot of companies, particularly tech companies and loosely in our space, that have done really badly in that. You know, they've thought, great, we're going to do this great thing. We're going to hire 20 devs or 20-somethings, and then the business just doesn't come, and you've got this, you know, suffocating OPEX every month. You know, you've been a founder yourself, making, you know, what it's like when monthly pay cycles come around. It's terrifying sometimes. I think a lot of companies have maybe ambitiously made some poor choices there. We've got an amazing team working for us. We've made one or two hires that haven't quite worked out for various reasons. But we've got a really strong team. We've got capacity to do more, which is exciting. We always took the belief of systemize and automate and process improvement before you hire someone. You know, where can we shave half the headcount? We've always taken that view. We're a tech company. It'd be crazy if we didn't, to be honest with you. Literally every day, you know, Darren, my co-founder, and I have a conversation around something, around how we can do it better, what can we do. I think a big problem in the industry is human resource. Software devs they're hard to find, right? Really good devs who get your business, who appreciate the culture, and who are good at their job, really, really hard to find. I think you have to accept, as any company now, you've just got to pay the money for people. We've unearthed a couple of incredible grads One of our, you know, star employees was not that long out of university. He's been with us for a few years now. Incredible growth. We've just taken on an amazing grad. She's an absolute superstar. But they're hard to find. They're really, really hard to find. You know, people who you think you're going to trust quite soon. And so, you know, adding on experience to that is just really, really difficult. So I can't understate that enough. Yeah, but no, we're a grow the staff when we're at capacity bursting. Can't handle it anymore.
Fantastic. And you mentioned your co-founder as well. Is there any particular, you mentioned a couple of the regular conversations, any tactics you use to kind of keep developing and partnering as a co-founder? I think it's great to have that teamwork approach. Especially with lots of travel, lots of busyness. What are some of the tools you use with your co-founder and also your team maybe to help stay connected?
Yeah, we talk a lot. We talk a lot, very frankly. Darren, my co-founder, you know, we often say, you know, we've got, you know, 95% shared values, but about 5% shared skills, which has actually seen us in very good stead. We're both really candid with each other, which is, I think, it's incredibly important. You know, the founder piece, it wins or it loses, you know, with if you've got more than one founder, I think. And so we talk a lot. We always talk about cross-training around how we can do stuff. I learn as much as I can about his world without having to do it, and vice versa. You know, most of our staff are more on the technical side of things, which is not overly my strength. It's Darren's strength. You know, when we have team meetings, it's all of us. When we have a job meeting, it's all of us. You know, we've got a support person. She's in all the sales meetings and the technical meetings. And I think as a small company, as we grow, partly to ensure the culture is hopefully going in the right direction, but just to, you know, cross-training, and everyone knows everyone's got an opinion. No one's afraid to say, hey, should we be doing this differently? And I think that has to come from just collaboration and everyone kind of being in the mix together. But we talk a lot, like we talk a lot.
Yeah, that's great around the communication side. Amazing, mate. Really, really great to hear all the stories and how it's progressing, a bit about how it's coming up. And lastly, just I guess on a side note, any like favorite podcasts or books you've read that have kind of helped your thinking in this area or guided you anyway? Anything? Any resources for maybe first time entrepreneurs or people trying to get into this space?
I think the biggest resource is other founders. I can't stress that enough. There's some great books out there and podcasts. I like football podcasts, soccer football podcast personally. Peter Grouch one's my favorite, a little bit of a plug there. But yeah, I just think talking to other founders and don't be ashamed of it. I've found it so therapeutic sometimes just to have you have to have trust with other founders, but I think there's this unspoken trust sometimes that you say things that you wouldn't say to anyone else. You know, you download, you cry on a shoulder, you ask questions that you wouldn't feel you should ask anyone at all. And I think that's the biggest resource. And there's thousands of us in Australia, you know. And so, you know, buddy up, find a cohort, you know, find a climate side or a boot camp or something that you feel comfortable in and just kind of open yourself up and be a bit exposed. I think it's the best way to learn. But it's really helping. I've been on a few of the accelerators and things like that. Yeah, it's phenomenal learning, yeah.
Fantastic. And one last one as an extra to that. I get a lot of people saying, you know, I'd love to work in climate, but I don't have any credentials. Like I don't have an environmental degree or sustainability degree. In terms of you, your team, like is that a valid concern?
No, not at all. Our ops person was working in hospitality before. She's amazing. Everyone else, there's five of us in total. The others are absolutely educationally or, you know, heavily work qualified. My background before I was in tech was I was in corporate for 20 odd years. Absolutely no idea. Couldn't change a light bulb. I think you've got to love it and you've got to apply yourself to it and keep on asking questions. It's the basic stuff. It's one of the most easy industries in the world to break into, to be honest with you, because all you've got to do is want to do it. It's just, you know, probably wouldn't apply that to medicine or law, but if you want to get into climate, you just got to, you know, appreciate it, learn, rock up to events and just jump in. Pretty simple.
And Liverpool's got a big game on the weekend against Man City. Let's predict the score. It's coming in advance. By the time this comes out, people will know it'll be real. What do you think?
3-1 Liverpool.
I'm going 2-0 Liverpool.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I do honestly think we'll win, but you can't deny the Man City. I think it's too early for them, but if they turn on, it'll be a great game anyway. But yeah, 3-1, pretty confident. Luis Diaz double. I'm just going to pick that.
we've doubled outside of the climate industry, but added a bit of fun for ourselves. And I think it's important. Again, this is a marathon, not a sprint. I think we're in for a really. You know, I think there's there's a big danger of kind of aiming for 2050 as goals, but there's also an equal danger of expecting everything to change instantly. So staying healthy, enjoying a bit of side projects here and there is also really healthy. And Dan, it's been great to get to know you and work with you over the last few years and seeing DNA grow and grow and thrive. Thanks so much for sharing today. And again, a huge thanks to the New South Wales Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water for their support of this industry and the importance of its future. And again, Dan, thanks for sharing.
Thanks, Nick. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed it. Have a great day.